right, if people are not on the appropriate page, as I'm not, they should be on the speaking queue page. Right, okay. Right, that was a little bit abrupt, so we haven't got anyone there at the moment, but... oh, Paddy, you're there. Go on, do.
Well, speak. I just thought, I'd throw in the a kind of obvious question before anyone else does, which is, if you've got a, I'm not quite sure what you're proposing, Leon, whether you were talking about decision making in socialism or decision making now, I wasn't quite clear, but leaving that aside. This is kind of obvious question, isn't there, of who guards the guardians? You know, if you've got scientists making the decisions over technical things, how do you know that they are making those decisions for technically justifiable reasons? And how do you know that they haven't been got at?
Excellent question. So just to answer your first bit, in socialism. So right now it's incorrigible. There's nothing we can do about it. So I'm thinking about the next better system. And then how to make sure, if you look at the system of science at the moment, right now as it is, it's already quite good and it's better than any other system I know. It works brilliantly. The only places where it falls short is where money is involved. So when you have grants, people want to apply for funding, they want to... so sometimes there's a lot of that. When, again, people want to get more money, then they cheat. If you take the money out of the equation, then everything else in the scientific system starts working much stronger, which is peer review. And that system works really amazingly well. So you get checked by a lot of other scientists, and unless everybody says, or at least the vast majority says, that yes, you are saying something that they have also seen, that they have checked, they have confirmed as working, then they say that what I'm saying must be true. And so it's published, it's peer-reviewed, it's checked and rechecked, and then that system itself grows and grows and grows and becomes better and better. And so, like I said, it's already working quite remarkably well. And I'd say if you take money out of the equation, it will work even better. However, of course, I do realize that there are problem spots, because now it works very well in areas where you can experiment. So you can prove something wrong using an experiment. If we introduce social sciences, it's a lot harder to do. So in higher level decisions where you have to combine social sciences, maths, everything, then yes, it has to be several people at already high level of decision making in science working together. And then it's just a matter of trust that in a system where there's no money, they will not want to make a mistake, or they will make the best decision anyway. And there's nobody who can make a better one.
Okay. Thanks, Leon. We've got a number of people in the speaking queue now. First, Mike.
Thank you. Yeah, and that's given us a few things to talk about. My question, which I think you sort of started to cover in your last couple of sentences, was in the kind of system you're suggesting. How would you define a scientist? And, you know, you mentioned there about social sciences being a slightly different discipline to the, you know, the more sort of physical sciences. And you also mentioned about those sort of working on the sort of the higher end of science. But and I suppose that could be you could then sort of define a scientist as someone who's working, a laboratory with a good reputation, or a university. But again, I was wondering how sort of broad your definition of scientist would be. I mean, you could have someone who, knows the ins and outs, but doesn't work for, the right institution, if you like, or someone who might not want to work for the a scientific institution which would then confer them the ability to make decisions. I just wouldn't mind hearing a bit more about how you would define a scientist and sort of how broad that definition would be. Thank you.
Yes, scientist for me is quite a broad notion, because I would say that anybody who's done a doctorate where they had to be counting something would be a scientist, simply because that experience of struggling with the objective reality and realizing that your assumptions are 95% of the times wrong for several years just does something to people. It brings sort of humility that other people don't have. The people who say, this theory is right or wrong, conspiracy theories I'm talking about. So, yeah, very, very broad definition. And then if we want to tackle a specific problem, then obviously these people may not have the expertise to do it. So they will contact those scientists who are working in that field more. So scientists who continue their science work, and then ask those people to contribute, because you don't actually need that many people to contribute unless it's a universal problem like the climate change. I hope that makes sense, or if I need to clarify that.
No, thank you. Yeah, cheers.
Okay, thanks, Leon. It's Nick next.
Thanks for the talk, Leon. Very interesting. I've had a few questions, really. It seems that you're sort of portraying quite an elitist kind of rule here. I mean, if you look at aspects like morals, ethical decisions and views, I mean, what would make a scientist or someone who studied the physical sciences or the social sciences, whatever, you know, more suitable or any better than the next person for those kind of decisions? The other thing is that a lot of scientific decisions have a lot of political and social repercussions to them. So, again, you can argue that the scientists, are they really experts in this? Why would they know more than the next person? And how do you separate, scientific reasoning from these other social, ethical, and moral decisions? So there's a few questions there.
Thanks, Nick. So this is something that I spoke about very briefly at the very end, and it's definitely a question to think about. So it's not clear cut at all. I will try to answer maybe some part of it. As first of all, I would ask a question, then why not? So the notion that ethics is somehow outside the field of human knowledge, I think, ultimately comes from religion. Religious people think that this is God. This comes from heaven. We are somehow given the ethics, or it's all in the Bible and so on. But then there's been some brilliant British philosophers who analyzed ethics, wrote books about it, and it is part of modern science of psychology, ethics, actually. And so I believe that these people who are studying it, they do know more about it than probably you or me, because I've personally never, well, I have studied it a little bit, but I'm not at all a scientist from that point of view. So, but I do think that those people know it better. Why not? That's my question. Why not treat ethics as a science, one of the sciences? It is, in fact, possible to measure, if even just by subjective reports, people's levels of satisfaction and happiness. If you're talking about ethics from the point of view of what's right or wrong, again, there's some works that are known, have been known for the last 200-300 years. Basically just, well, you can treat it as a sum of human happiness and satisfaction. So that's one way to deal with it. And the same is about politics or social issues. Again, you take the sum of people's satisfaction and you try to see which changes in the society bring the better results and treat it scientifically. I haven't seen any avenue of human activity that would be outside a scientific approach. And in fact, the only times when I have seen that people were against it, those were people who are not familiar with science.
Thanks, Leon. It's Darren next.
Hi, Leon. Interesting talk. I don't come from a scientific background, so apologies for my, you know, like layperson response to your talk. I guess one question that arises out of what you're suggesting, and you kind of briefly mentioned Keith Graham's Battle of Democracy. I see the socialist project, if you like, as, you know, the battle of democracy. It's about the working class acting in its own self-interest to achieve socialist consciousness, to, you know, for a majoritarian revolution to establish, you know, a classless society, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm just finding it, trying to get my head around this idea that we're talking about a participatory revolution, the self-emancipation of the working class. And then, if you want to say we get to that point, we then are seemingly going to suddenly decide, if you like, abdicate that responsibility to scientists, to a group of people over there who are seemingly, you know, once the cash nexus or whatever has been removed from the equation, will seemingly act in a fashion, you know, which would, you know, be in the interest of the majority of society. I'm not saying that wouldn't be the case, you know, I generally don't know, but my point is that we're part of it. Our argument is that the working class has a confidence in itself for political, social, and economic democracy. And then once we get to that point, we're almost like giving part of that democracy away. That's what, at this point, I can't get my head around what you're suggesting. You know, it's almost like, it kind of reminds me, you know, I apologize if this is stretching it too far, but if you look at the early Bolsheviks, you know, after the Russian Revolution, it was the engineers, you know, I think studies have been made that the engineers, like, made up a great proportion of, you know, professional revolutionaries, not just in the Soviet Union. You look at Britain, a lot of the early communists were engineers. And it was almost like, you know, this idea of the benevolent, enlightened expert acting on behalf of the rest of us. And I think that taking that view, you kind of, I personally think we lose sight of basically what socialism is about. I understand we can't decide on everything. I wouldn't assume they have like an equal voice on issues that I don't fully understand. But at the same time, I think mechanisms should be in place for the greatest voice, you know, the greatest participation in general running of society. That's just some initial thoughts, but it was a really interesting talk, and thank you.
Thank you. These are some really, really good questions to think about, because it's about everyone, about how everybody feels themselves, their position within the society, their struggle, and what brings people together. Also, I absolutely agree with the idea that nobody wants to have a kind of group of enlightened people there somewhere deciding everything for them. And I wouldn't have that myself. It's very difficult to talk about a society of the future from the point of view of what we have now. And also, as you mentioned, kind of in transition, also how it can be done. I know about the Bolsheviks example and the engineers. And actually, the way I see those engineers is they are halfway towards the scientific, let's say, status or mindset. But anyhow, just to start tackling this a little bit, the way I see it, at least, is, first of all, the society is changing. So let's take Britain, for example. The kind of jobs we have now are moving steadily from manufacture towards services. At the same time, the level of education is still increasing. More and more people attend universities. I think this trend is going to continue. So there's going to be more and more people going to universities and being just generally closer to scientists. So they will not already think of scientists, quote, as somebody who is sitting in the ivory tower. I personally had to have this problem that I was one of the PhD students who is among the increasingly huge number of people who finish their studies and then they have nothing to do. There's no jobs for us. Nobody really needs this kind of expertise, and this is only going to grow. So this is the kind of, if you know what I'm getting at here, is this is the general trend. This is where we are going. There are going to be more and more people like this, better informed, better educated, closer to science. So that's just one way how it's going to be. The second thing I wanted to mention is also, it was part of my talk during the summer school on technologies, digital technologies, which in the beginning of 20th century, it just was not possible. But now, using digital technologies, there could be a lot more transparency. So again, it's not people in the ivory tower sitting somewhere and deciding things for us. It's there, for example, online, where we can come and see in real time how this decision-making is taking place. And we can make it subject to scrutiny, again, in real time, by linking it to some other people with their opinions. So using digital technologies, it can be brought a lot closer to people. And if more people feel closer and that they can engage with this decision-making, the better is going to be the end result, in my opinion. But I completely agree with you that this is a difficult problem, and yeah, it warrants a lot more discussion than this. So thank you for this.
Thanks, Leon. Right, we've got a good number of people in the queue now, and it's Brian next.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, interesting subject that's been near to my heart and thinking for a long, long time. Just briefly, what I'm bringing up touches on the concerns that was bridged by Darren in regards to the decision-making process. Right. The first dictum that we've got to remember in regards to the decision-making process and the scientific community is that the scientists advise and society decides. Right. Now, unless the scientists can get the support of society on its side, none of its theories are going to be of any practical benefit, right? It's got to gain the support. So it's got to put its theories through the decision-making process in order to gain the support. Now, the first thing it's got to do is get whatever theory it comes up with and it thinks it's got a practical application, is get it on the agenda. So that means an appeal to the general society. Now, where that goes, you know, if it gets accepted through the decision-making process, right, it then taken up to the next level, which is, you know, from the community level up to the regional level. and then from the regional level up to the continental level, and then up to the world level, if so necessary. You know, there'll be some scientific theories, right, that don't need to go any further other than the community level, because they're only practical on at the community level. And so it goes on. Right. My concern is, right, that it'd be so many scientific theories, right, that society will be overwhelmed, and there'll have to be another decision-making process in order to whittle them down. Otherwise, they're not going to be heard. The ones that is going to be of most practical benefit, etc. Right. How they whittle it down, I got no idea at all. But it's pretty obvious, you know, that society, whether or not it will support the scientific theories as a practical measure. Right. Without the support from society, none of these scientific theories are going to go forward whatsoever.
There's a key point there, Leon, I think, in what Brian has to say. Do you want to say something about it?
Yeah, just to mention briefly that I do this as my job, actually, just talking to scientists and offering their advice to policymakers. And so basically, I see that the first part of your question, the problem that you mentioned, is not really a problem, because that's this plethora of scientific theories, it doesn't really exist. These smaller, non-important theories just get shut down very quickly from within the scientific community. So it's just not a problem at all. And those really important scientific theories, when they come to that level of policymaking, what happens, what I see happens now, is politicians come and say, sorry, we don't have the money for that, or we have our own interests. So there's very clear, on this, from the scientists, there's a lot of ethical considerations there that I see. And then from the politicians, they come and say, yeah, we need this, no, don't need that, sorry. So to me, this is such a clear line that we just need to get rid of. I hope that answers a little bit your question.
Well, it does. It does, and it doesn't, Leon. Right? Because what my question was aimed at was the decision-making process within the socialist society. Right? Nothing to do with money whatsoever. Right? But of course, the scientific theories will still be restricted by the amount of support that's given by society as a whole. Especially a material support, not just in physical support, etc., but the material support. Now, scientists can't carry out their experiments and their peer-to-peer reviews, etc., without this material support. And in order to get this material support, they've got to approach society and go down through the decision-making process.
Yeah, this is completely valid concern. So just try to think of it not from the point of view of we're not going to let you, but from the point of view of what can you, the scientist, give us. So rather than saying, okay, that those crazy scientists that want to do this and this and that and everything and want to get all the resources, think of it more from the social social order kind of. So the society comes up with, what do we want as a society? We want to have better houses, I don't know, faster cars, what have you, better health care, and so on. So this is the order that the society places. We want this. And then it asks the scientists, can you give it to us? For us, these are the priorities. This is what we want. This is what my talk was about. From the society, we ask, what do you want? Not how to give it, but what. And then if you say that this is what you want, then why would you want to limit the resources that you're giving? You want it.
Okay, interesting discussion. Shall we move on to Keith then? Keith, you're next.
Okay, thanks. Well, thanks, Leon. Really interesting, challenging stuff. And I'll be very, very brief. I think really I'm following up some of the things that Darren was saying. I suppose underlying your view, there's got to be some kind of assumption of the order that we're not very good at making decisions, we people in general, and some other smaller group of people are better. Well, I mean, let's perhaps leave aside the question whether that's correct. I think you don't establish it by showing that we, the people in general, sometimes make bad decisions, because then you'd have to point to any decision-making system which never had that result, and I don't think you'd find it. The question, which is kind of obvious to raise at this point, and that's the question, well, given how good or bad we are at making decisions, could we get better? Could we improve it? And if so, how could that come about? That's an obvious question to raise, and in a way, I think I'd want to suggest the obvious answer to it, that an arena in which people can get better at making decisions is in the movement itself for a social change. And I think, let's not be too modest about the party's own role in this. Anyone who joins the party is immediately on an equal footing with anyone else in the party. And there are structures there for decision making. There are structures for bad decisions to be reviewed. And, you know, we ought perhaps to emphasize more frequently than we do how very, very different that is from any other political party. I mean, I haven't even mentioned the fact that we don't have leaders. But what is done in the name of the party by any subset of members, such as the EC, is under the control of the party itself. And that gives an arena in which people can learn to make better decisions. Okay, I'll stop there. Thanks.
That's a very interesting way to look at it, Keith. Thank you. So one thing that I wanted to point out is that I would really like to stress that I am not trying to divide the society into groups of people. I'm strictly against divisions. I don't want to say that these are people who are better decision-making and those are people who are worse. What ideally I would like to see is some kind of system, maybe with using digital technologies, maybe not, I'm not sure, where people wouldn't have to make decisions, because we, as biological machines, we have biases. This is inside our biology. Yes, we can try to learn to get better at it, but we will never be perfect at it simply by the nature of who we are. We are biological systems. We are biased. So the best decisions are taken when we include mathematics, computers, all these non-human things. This is how, I don't know, you count, for example, jabs for COVID. How much benefit to the society this or that this will be. When the doctors are doing it, they are counting things. They're not thinking with their heart, even though we think just intuitively that, oh my God, this is the right thing to do. But in fact, if you really want the society to benefit, you have to count. So I would ideally like to exclude all of us from decision-making and at the same time include all of us in creating the system that will help us make better or perfect decisions. So thinking specifically about people in the party is very interesting because, well, we don't really have to make a lot of decisions here. And those decisions that we do make They're mainly about our immediate surroundings, which should be taken democratically, and this is what we do. So this is one of my concerns, that if, when it gets bigger, to a bigger level, then we'll get in trouble, because it is working well now. But once there are more people, it might not. And what are we going to do then? But again, I have more questions than answers, I guess. So definitely worth thinking about it.
Thanks, Leon. Freddie now.
Yeah, thank you. Leon, you know, forgive me and other comrades if necessary. I'm not entirely sure what it is you're advocating. Because at the outset of your address, you were talking about democracy and people's happiness, etc., and I was following it. So I have to say, you know, perhaps even through my own ignorance, I stopped following what it was you were actually advocating. Now, for me, when you're talking about happiness, for example, we know that studies are held elsewhere and some countries come out as happier than others, etc. I mean, I would say that personally, I mean, I'm sort of reasonably happy in most ways. But what I get distinctly unhappy about is the crime and the war and the poverty and the lack of housing, etc. That the people throughout the world don't enjoy to the extent that that some others do. So, you know, what I'm really trying to understand, what is it you're actually advocating? I mean, I can't go along with this this idea. This, as the Socialist Party, for me, analyse capitalism well. And I'm not a great one for trying to quote Karl Marx, etc., because substantially what the party has proved itself to be more than able, the Socialist Party has been proved itself more than able to carry on from the analysis of capitalism. What I'm trying to look at here is, though, what is it you're advocating? I don't see where the decision-making becomes a problem. Because, and that people make the decisions, the people as a whole, not a group of scientists somewhere, then start to make the decisions. As socialist understanding develops throughout the world, then surely how these decisions, etc., are made will be developed also. You know, and when you talk about the digital technology, yes, I can see that being used on a worldwide basis in terms of communications, etc., as to what's happening. But I don't see where we would rely on just perhaps some scientists somewhere to determine what it is we're doing. Society as a whole will determine that. So forgive me if I can't understand you properly, and if you can elaborate upon what it is you're actually advocating, it would certainly be of a help to me. Thank you.
Yes, I can. I will try to keep it short, not really elaborate, but rather simplify maybe a little bit. So what I'm saying is, in the past, there were very few decision makers, kings, rulers, who say, I said so, and it will be so. Then later people said, no, wait, we all want to decide, the people. And so they introduced democracy, or representative democracy, or whatever. But it's not working now. Why? Because, yeah, they do say we all decide, but in fact, we're not. They're just manipulating people's minds, people's ideas. They're just telling them, I don't know, there's been falsified election results. So they go and they storm the White House. It's manipulation. So in fact, it's not the people who are ruling. And what I'm saying is, I think I'm just worried that this kind of manipulation, just saying, oh, those people want it, because actually I want it, that this is going to continue. So what I'm proposing is that the baseline, that common denominator for making decisions is not this society, there's some society somewhere, which is actually not any more concrete than some scientists that you're mentioning. It's also some society as a whole. But scientific truth, evidence, something that we can prove, something that is a common denominator in the sciences right now. So we eliminate people from the equation so they cannot be manipulated. And once we have digital technology to check that this is in fact true, then we have better decision making. This is what I'm saying. To eliminate manipulation, lies from the equation, base all decision making on sound facts and logic.
Can I come back in that, please, Howard?
Yeah. Okay, Freddie, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for that. Listen, when you say people are manipulated, we know what the capitalist system does to us. It gets to try and think us down a particular route. And, you know, when successive governments or whatever are issuing their manifestos, that's a manipulation as well. They're promising us the earth, you know. And yes, it very, very rarely happens. So people become less and less interested at times in politics. But I still don't get this idea of taking people, human beings, out of it sounds to me as if they're going to be coming out of the equation. And if I've got that wrong, then forgive me. But as socialist understanding becomes more aware nationally, internet, globally, the amount of manipulation might even try to be more intense. But workers will become far more aware of what's happening and will not get conned by that. So this is where, in all honesty, I'm having some difficulty with what is being suggested. And if I'm misunderstanding you, forgive me. Thanks.
No, I'm afraid that this could be a common misunderstanding, and it could be a weakness in probably how I present the idea. So I'm not trying to take humans out of the equation. I'm trying to take human weakness, the possibility of human manipulation out of the equation. But in the end, I actually want more people, or ideally everybody, to be involved in this kind of decision making, but in collective building of the system that will help us make decisions together, really together. Sorry, I'm not sure if it's making any better my explanation.
Should we move on to Steve then? Steve, it's you next.
Yeah, thank you. I hope I've not missed something earlier. The connection dropped out, and I couldn't hear what Comrade Graham said. So I hope back over something that's already been raised. First of all, thank you very much, Leon. I was interested by what Paddy said, because he brought in what initially I was thinking, well, it's a bit of a red herring, this about who guards the guardians. But no, you seem to be saying the same thing, Nicholas, Leon, unless I've got you wrong. And I think you seem to be leaving out of the equation. If you're looking for a system that is going to stop people being manipulated, on earth be the motive for people to tell lies, to falsify information, what would be the motive in a socialist society? Because we've got now all the social controls over how wealth is distributed, and there would be there is nothing to be gained from acting in the way that is portrayed as natural and under a capitalist society. It seems from what you've just said, and I'm sorry, I've not tried fully to reflect on it. It seems from what you've just said that you seem to be thinking the same thing, that there is something inevitable in a social society where people are out to con folk. I think, okay, I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
I don't think you're saying that, are you, Leon? But go on, if you want to answer.
No, it's an interesting point. So yes, when I'm talking about manipulation or conning, no, I don't think that socialists will want to do that. What I see kind of envision in my mind is that a lot of people in the socialist society will have ideas about how, in their view, the perfect society looks, what they would like to see. So in this situation, I imagine a chorus of voices all kind of in dissonance, trying to shout over each other. And so in this situation, we would need this system of decision making really desperately to already or have some kind of idea how the system can work to bring order so that people are in accord with each other about what it is that they want to change and how. Because we just somehow assume that, yes, once socialism comes, it's going to be paradise, or, well, people will figure it out. Yes, being optimistic, I also am optimistic, but I'm saying maybe we can already start thinking about how to do that. So if you bring that common denominator of science in the equation, then we can all find agreement easier, is what I'm saying. Does that make sense?
Okay.
Howard, can I just very brief?
Sure. Okay, yeah. Steve, go on, yeah.
I wasn't at all suggesting that socialism is a paradise. Socialism is going to have a material basis that allows this sort of discussion to go in equality and in peaceful. No, I don't think we're going to all be suddenly loved up with each other. Obviously, there will be disagreement. And I totally agree with what you're saying. And with what Freddie was saying before, by the way, about this idea of people will be able to decide this type of thing in social circumstances. That at the moment, we've not really got an idea. Because, first of all, we don't know about the technology. Secondly, we don't know about how people want to decide to organise themselves. So, okay. And by the way, we ought to, for people who aren't party members, we ought to refer to the why we do not put forward blueprints, detailed blueprints for a socialist society, because it all depends on the level of technology that's like the material conditions at the time of the socialist revolution. We have an idea of the general shape of society. Worldwide, moneyless, classless, with production for use, but we can't go beyond that. Well, we don't go into much more detail than that for a particular historical. Okay, if I could leave it at that, I do. Sorry, I'll take up too much time.
Thanks, Steve. Glenn, it's your turn now.
Oh, thank you, Howard, and thank you, Leon, and good evening, everybody. The problem coming a little bit down the speaking queue is that everybody makes very interesting points. I'm sort of writing notes here, but I'm going to try and keep it brief and come back to the very early points that I got from Leon. One thing I think we probably all fall foul of this, and certainly people that I talk to, and when you're discussing socialism, I mentioned this before once, but it's very, very difficult, I think, to try and figure out, if you like, or sort of predict how people might behave in a socialist society, because what we tend to be totally conditioned to think is how people behave in this society. And I think some of the things Leon was saying could easily be viewed, at least with that in mind. So we're talking about scientists, and if you like, giving them not quite carte blanche, but we're sort of suggesting that, you know, those sorts of decisions that involve science perhaps can be left to those people. And I think if a socialist society, let's hope it is established, what I think would happen in that society is there would be a wide level of trust, because the sorts of things that make scientists function now wouldn't exist. So, for example, I can tell you about my own daughter. My older daughter is a doctor, and she's specialized recently in child psychiatry. But when she was studying medicine, it was fascinating to talk to her, because one of the things they dealt with in medicine, of course, as we all know, is ethics. And how do you make a decision? Do you give certain people certain medicines if their lifestyle in some people's minds doesn't allow that, if you see what I mean? I mean, I won't give examples. I'm sure you know what I mean. You could arguably say if someone, for instance, went rock climbing and constantly engaged in dangerous sport, you know, do you mend their broken leg before a child's? It's that sort of thing, only some of it clearly much deeper. But what the point I'm making there is ethics very definitely involve money. So, you know, if the drugs weren't available because they cost too much, do you let the person die? And so this is kind of viewing things in a capitalist society. But of course, in socialism, those sorts of considerations would evaporate. And so coming back to Leon's earlier points, he made a couple. One was about peer-reviewed papers. Now, Adam's kindly asked me to do a talk on the environment and the climate in a few weeks' time. So I'm not really going to go in a huge amount of detail on this, but one of the books I'll be looking at is a very recent book. Some of you may have read it, by a chap called Michael Mann. It's called The New Climate Wars. And Leon, in this one, he makes some points that were very interesting that I didn't know. And that is that we all perceive scientists as being these sort of, you know, straighter than a die kind of people and so on and so forth, who you know, do their best for their careers and so on. But in reality, these peer-reviewed papers you mentioned are nowhere near as reliable as we think they are. Now, if one take this book, incidentally, was heavily researched, and I can't, it's not to hand, otherwise I'd quote it, but I probably will do this on the 23rd. But these peer-reviewed papers very often use references and quotes that go back a long, long way. And the point he was making is that these scientists are chasing money, so they don't have time to research these papers properly. So a few names get added into these so-called peer-reviewed papers, and they're given the rubber stamp and they go through. So let's not attach too much importance to those. But I think what we should be saying to ourselves is that in a socialist society, the fantastic thing about it would be that these scientists wouldn't, they're working people. They're chasing money at the moment, and they've got a living. So they can be tainted, they can be led, they can work for fossil fuel companies and say the wrong things. They have to suffer their papers being censored sometimes, like the US government did recently. So I think the great thing about socialism will be that these people will be free to study what they are good at in a way that will be entirely conducive to the the proper running of world society. And that would be a fantastic thing. And like, you know, if you want science, you go to a scientist. If you want food, you go to a farmer. But these people will be respected and welcomed for their views. I don't really think that there will be any need for some sort of clandestine decision making. I think, you know, they'd be respected, and it will be accepted that, you know, experts in their area will share their views. There'd be no, if you like, coercion. There wouldn't be any need of that. So it absolutely wouldn't be needed. So I think pretty much that's all I was going to say, Leon, but I hope that's some help. But I kind of might go into the climate stuff more detail on the 23rd, but thank you very much.
I sort of think that's more or less what you were saying, Leon, but do confirm or deny.
Yes. Thank you very much, Glenn. That is what I'm saying. And I think even in a sort of better climate for scientists, they will still viciously attack each other, because that's just the way scientists are. And this is good, because in the end, the truth will prevail. Just thank you. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, it's Nick again now.
Hi. One of the things that's, you know, listening to Leon's argument and the discussion, which I'm having trouble to agree with, really, is this view that somehow scientists are able to make and influence decisions in the way that Leon's indicating they can and do. Having spent 30 years as an engineer designing chips in the semiconductor industry, being surrounded by a couple of hundred PhDs, I know these scientists. I mean, directly, you know, I've worked on artificial intelligence chips, CPUs, GPUs, machine learning. Most of this high tech stuff that I've been working on over the last 30 years, it's all been directed by government, and in a lot of cases by the military. A lot of the research projects were all the decisions on what to build are not made by the guys who are actually doing the design work and building these systems. They're made by governments and large corporations. I mean, the last project I was working on was for some guys working in the stock exchange, where they had to build a network chip that was faster than anything else in order to make a few bucks, because a few microseconds increase in speed meant that they could make better forecasts. It was for a hedge fund company, you know, and that was a massively a huge project, cost millions. Is that useful for society? I don't think so. But yeah, I think there's too much emphasis, you know, thinking that, well, you know, it's the scientists that are driving things, and I would argue that's not the case. It's done by government and big corporations. That's my point.
Glenn, can you mute? We've got a bit of feedback coming from you. Thanks. Do you want to say anything in response, Leon?
I never claimed that scientists are running things. I totally agree with you. Scientists are spending ridiculous amounts of resources. Well, you could say money at the moment, but resources, which shouldn't be. It's unbelievable how much is wasted simply because grants are put wrong directions and governments are ordering wrong stuff, and because a lot of things are being researched for monetary profit. So yeah, hopefully in a socialist society, this will not happen anymore.
Thanks, Leon. Mike, it's you again now.
Thank you. Yeah. Of course, at the moment, scientists, you know, don't have the casting vote in decision making. So, and as others have said, science is sort of impacted on by economics and politics. And that got me thinking, and it reminded me of a book that came out about 10 years ago that maybe shed some light on what kind of sort of mindset or ideology or culture you might have in a society where scientists are much more prominent and their decisions have wider impacts. And the book is called The Atheist Guide to Reality by Alex Rosenberg, which is quite a scary book, really, with some of its implications. And I'm not saying I agree with it. I think he takes things too far. But his premise is, or his sort of his basic argument rather, is that if you apply, or if you have a sort of hardline scientific outlook, and atheism would be a part of that, then if you apply that mindset and the scientific process to concepts and ways of doing things which are sort of fuzzily non-scientific, such as purpose, ethics, meaning, our sense of self, emotions. He said that if you apply the scientific approach to those, you'd realise that there's no free will, that if you explain things scientifically, that leads to a belief in biological determinism, that everything can be explained as cause and effect in causal chains. And he says we should abandon a belief in concepts like purpose and meaning as a consequence of that. He thinks they came out of a sort of a false premise that doesn't have a scientific basis. And he doesn't really go into the political implications of that too much. He says that would lead to a more cooperative, kinder society, because we'd recognise that we're all sort of linked, that it's evolutionarily advantageous to promote the species' well-being. But that there is, as I say, there are some uncomfortable implications of beliefs we have about, our sense of self, sense of free will, sense of moral agency. So I think if we apply his arguments, which of course are the arguments of one person, and the book has come under quite a bit of criticism for taking things too far down the hardline scientific determinist route, it does raise the question that scientists would, if in a prominent decision-making role in our society, that would impact on concepts and frameworks if you apply a scientific analysis to them, which of course society doesn't at the moment, because institutions, ideology and framework are shaped by economic forces. So I think a scientific society would be colored by scientific prerogatives, and of course we can't really predict how that might play out in practice, but interesting, I thought. So the book was like The Atheist Guide to Reality by Alex Rosenberg. I'll put something in the useful links channel for it. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Shall we go on to Dougie now? Dougie, you next.
Yeah, it's interesting, really. But I mean, a lot of science is all to do with patents and, secrets and not telling people, not sharing things and, trying to make money. I mean, the advances we've had through capitalism have been quite fundamental, light bulbs, electricity, gas central heating. Homes are completely different now than they were 200 years ago and things. And a lot of that was due to innovation by scientists, coming up with the light bulb and different things like that, really, But I mean, I think you missed the point. If you look at the world, there's some countries are going to be rapidly screwed by global warming, really, So if the world's making decisions in favour of them, not in favour of somebody like Donald Trump who denies climate change and thinks the Earth's getting cooler. I mean, it beggars belief. But, I mean, scientists are just human beings, really, So their review would help to iron things out. But I think the majority of people would want to make decisions on things like global warming and things. I mean, a lot of science is all about weapons and, making money and computer programs to do well with shares and things like that. So, I mean, a lot of science is a waste of time. But, I mean, science used properly, where they're creating drugs for illnesses and things like that. I mean, you just have to look at the pandemic, really. Some countries are doing better than others. But, really, they should be sharing the production of the vaccine and things like that. And it should be produced everywhere so that people can be protected from the virus. I mean, you just have to look at what's going on in Brazil and compare that to what's happening in the UK at the moment. And you can see how different attitudes to science can be very bad for people.
Leon, do you want to comment?
No, it's okay.
Okay, fine. All right. It's Paddy next. Paddy.
Dougie just said part of what I was going to say, really, on one thing about, scientists being human beings just like the rest of us. I mean, so they have cognitive biases. They're not supposed to, but they do. They often have reputations to defend, which can blind them to, uncomfortable facts. They can get set in their ways. I like reading about science. I like reading science gossip as well. So, people like Ben Goldacre, who talk about eminence-based medicine rather than evidence-based medicine. This is the fact that, medical experts are fallible. This isn't to do with money. It's just that they've got hubris. And Lee Smolin, who's a particle theoretical physicist, He talks about the string theory mafia. You know, they've got it sewn up. You can't get any, you know, nobody wants to study his favourite thing, quantum gravity, because the string theorists have got it all sewn up and, you know, they are right and nobody dare argue with them. And and another theoretical physicist, Lawrence Krauss, who covered himself with shame recently and got fired. But he once said that because of these sorts of human fallibilities, science tends to progress one funeral at a time. You know, scientists don't change their minds, even in spite of the evidence. I just mention all these things just so that we don't get carried away with the idea that scientists are somehow, you know, more rational than the rest of us. You might expect that they would be, but not necessarily. But my other point was there seems to be a bit of a dichotomy being made here, or being assumed anyway, between scientists and non-scientists. And I think that this is part of what we experience in capitalism with this kind of cult of leadership. You know, we're trained not to ask questions. We're trained, you know, not to take an interest in science unless it's going to pay us a wage. I mean, in fact, most of us are trained to be afraid of science. And you know, capitalism loves these kind of binary divisions, doesn't it? It's got class divisions, race divisions, gender divisions. It's all us and them. And it's, you know, in academic terms, it's the division is between expert and idiot. We're basically always put off in capitalist culture by we're put off studying or finding out about anything that the bosses don't really want us to have an opinion about. Now, I'm not saying that in socialism everyone could be a scientist, but I don't think it's unreasonable to suggest that everyone could be science literate, much more than now. So the gulf between scientists and non-scientists would be a lot more blurred than it is at the moment. In socialism, people will have the time and I think probably the inclination to learn a lot more things about a lot more widely. And in fact, they'll need to do that in order to settle these kinds of debates that that we're talking about, that Leon's mentioned. There won't be a capitalist class to make the decisions for us, so people are going to need to be informed about these things, at least to the level of being able to make a decision about it. I mean, just imagine you've got a question in socialism like that goes like this: the people at CERN, they say they can't find out any new physics from the particle collider they've got at CERN. They want to build one 10 times the size. In fact, some of the physicists there do say that. On the other hand, you've got space exploration, and the exobiologists would like humanity to send a giant drill rig to the moons of Jupiter, Europa, for instance, drill through the ice and find out what biology is under there. Supposing that society can't really muster the energy to do both of those things, how does it decide which one of those things to do? It can't be the scientists. The physicists will want the particle collider. The exobiologists will want the probe to Europa. It has to be a decision for the wider society. And for that to be possible, the rest of society has to take much more of an interest, and I think will take much more of an interest in science than it does currently.
Thanks, Paddy. Do you want to comment, Leon, or does it speak for itself?
Couldn't be said better. Thank you very much, Paddy.
Okay, it's Darren next again.
Yeah, I do want to say something, but I did notice that the three people after me haven't spoken yet, so I'll pass and maybe come back if there's time.
Okay, if you still want to speak, then put your name on again, will you? Okay, Pat now.
Right, hello. Some things have obviously already been said, but what I wanted to say... followed on from something that was said earlier about scientists making decisions. And what came to mind was a particular example of the position in the oceans and the scientific view was that there should be, and I haven't got the figures with me, but the number of marine reserves that were needed in the oceans where there would not be any fishing permitted at all was quite a considerable number. But what was actually so far been implemented was far fewer numbers, because the scientists come study the facts, and bearing in mind what others have said about how scientists come to some of their decisions. In other words, their money is at the bottom of it. But of course, politicians make the decisions about how many of these marine reserves, for example, are going to be implemented, and it's based on economics and short-term decisions. Well, in socialist society, what would be possible would be objective information. And I had notes made here about not being just dependent on a few people being having the scientific knowledge, but that people could be more knowledgeable about scientific subjects if they wanted to be. And because Paddy put it rather better and said about people being more scientifically literate. But that's about it, really, that socialist society, the objective information would be possible. And obviously it's a worldwide system, but that the decisions that are needed to be made about conserving the environment, it would be possible to make them in the interests of humanity. Right, thank you.
Thanks, Pat. It's Paul's turn now.
Cheers, thank you, guys. And I mean, if you follow that, both what Pat and Paddy have just said, other than that, I have been taking a few notes myself, certainly a very stimulating conversation we're having tonight. Thoroughly enjoying it. I mean, I think you certainly highlighted the point of how, you know, we already have more than enough capacity, ability to produce what's needed by the worldwide population. But obviously, with competition being the motivation, none of these things are served as well as they could be. Obviously, within socialism, this is not a blueprint for or an advocacy for any advancement or how things might work in socialism, but merely my own interpretation. I think what you were certainly doing a good job. I certainly get the picture of what you're saying. In terms of, you know, things being as they are, you know, you've got either this kind of top-down or bottom-up kind of feature of modern society, you know, rather than, I would think socialism has been more of a sideways kind of structure. You know, you get people that are good, you get a number of crunchers and academics that are good at doing their thing, and you get people who are better at manual activities, but the beauty of it is, it will presumably they will all come together to meet the needs of everyone as one. In terms of decision making, obviously we've got the technology now that is likely to get better rather than stay the same or get worse. And we think about the algorithms, for example. You know, I don't think there will be a hierarchy per se. I think that, you know, people won't even be held on a pedestal, but there will be a mutual respect for people who, for example, if you look at weather forecasters nowadays, you know, they can come on your television every day and tell you what lies ahead, what's likely to be the weather tomorrow, and you know, relatively accurately now than they ever did 20 or 30 years ago, what's happening next week. So therefore, we can be better prepared for what lies ahead, and we can take the necessary action based on those scientific statistics on a cumulative level, you know, by either joint decision making collectively in small groups locally, or what we now term nationally or internationally, certainly across the world. So that's certainly some of the things that I would see. So that'd be the general problem solving would involve, you know, is looking at what lies ahead, what needs to be done ahead, and then backtrack from there, what we have to do collectively to get there, using the collective knowledge of those brains, for those what I sometimes refer to as pen pushers now, or you know, keyboard workers, people who do like to, we've got one in our own party here, Comrade Rob Cox, who likes nothing more than to sit on his computer doodling away, and what a terrific service he does for the party. That's his idea of heaven. That would be my idea of hell. But the fact is that we still manage to maintain a fairly well-balanced political party. Now, if you scale that kind of thing upwards to, you know, your street, your neighbourhood, your town, your village, and beyond that still, then that's the kind of thing I anticipate seeing socialism coming to be. Do we need to get to? Yeah, that was that. Just a minute, guys. So, yeah, I mean, the only other thing I would say was, if for anyone that hasn't read it, Paddy, you know, talk about peer reviews. Well, peer reviews being such as they are, where, as has been alluded to tonight and said in Paddy's excellent article in The Standard, how you know, the motivation is not for the benefit of all, for the corporation. Well, it might be for some, but for so many, a lot of these peer reviews are designed more so, you know, people will say what they need to say to get noticed in order to get their next wage, their next salary, whereas that won't be the motivation. So there will be definitely different attitudes prevail within socialism than what they do under capitalism. And I think that's probably best just left there, guys. But a terrific, thoroughly interesting evening again, everyone. Thanks a lot. It's certainly got my grey matter working. Cheers.
Thanks, Paul. Right, OK. Adam, it's you next.
No, I think it's a question of degree, how far we extend democratic decision-making to. We're not going to vote on everything. And I think Leon made a, you know, valid distinction between deciding what should be done and then deciding how it should be implemented. For instance, I mean, when I turn the tap on, I'm only interested that water should come out. I'm not interested in how it gets there or how the water works, which then brings me on to my second point. I think it's not scientists we should be talking about, but engineers. We're talking about the people who are actually going to have to, I mean, society decides it wants to build a tunnel or a bridge. Then you call in the engineers, or if they build a particular type of house, it's architects. So we're talking about people who are interested in astrophysics and all that. We're talking about more practical people than that. And there is, in fact, a tradition, socialist, communist tradition, of people who do think. I mean, the engineers in the Bolshevik engineers, like people like Bogdanov and so on, and also another Bolshevik, Bordiga, who's a left communist. These are people who said the decision should be made by engineers and not by popular decision of people that didn't know what the subject was. And of course, we've been talking at least a couple of times last month about the technocrats and Peter Joseph. I think that's, you know, this is their view as well. So I say my main point here is we've been talking about engineers making these technical decisions, not scientists in general. But there is one thing that has come up, sort of decision making process. It's the citizens' assembly, where they get ordinary lay people and give them a problem, but they're advised by people who, you know, by scientists and engineers and people who do know what the problem is and what and how it can be solved. So, I mean, we're not going to make every decision in socialism by voting on it. We can make, well, I think Leon just wanted it at local level. Maybe we could go a bit higher than that. But his distinction between making decisions as to what should be done and how it should be carried out is, I think, is a valid. Okay, thanks.
Anything you want to comment on there, Leon?
Yeah, maybe just a little bit. I totally agree, and thank you, Adam. I think this citizens' assembly method has been quite popular recently because it's one way how to sort of avoid or go around the normal representative democracy practices to actually give people voice, to actually enable them to say, no, this is what we want. We actually want something else, not what our so-called representatives are saying. And this is an incredibly good tool at the moment when we don't have anything better. I think in socialism, well, of course, for some really local decisions, we can do that. But otherwise, it will be organized in a different way, not citizens, it's not asking people occasionally from time to time, so, okay, tell us what you want, but more like constantly surveying the population, everybody, on what it is that makes people happier. So it's a non-stop process of constantly getting feedback from everyone on what they want, and then trying to achieve that through the efforts of, like you said, engineers and scientists.
Thanks, Leon. Since there's nobody else in the queue, I've put myself next, and just want to raise, well, one point, really. In the sort of interaction between what you might call scientists or engineers and the wider public in a socialist society, it seems to me there are sort of two possible issues that can arise, which would mean that scientists or engineers would have to defer to the wider view. One is the thing Paddy mentioned, when it's a question of resources, really, because socialism won't be society of superabundance. It will be society of abundance. But nevertheless, we won't be able to do absolutely everything all the time. So if, you know, there is a problem about whether we have, a bigger Hadron Collider, or we, you know, send somebody up to another planet, and there just aren't the resources or maybe the expertise available to do both, then a decision will have to be made, which one. And that's the kind of decision that it seems to me would be made broadly, societally, if you like, rather than amongst experts. Once society has decided, I think a socialist society would then leave it to the experts to get on with it. I think Leon has sort of said this, and not want to sort of intervene all the time, ask them what they're doing and how they're doing it. It will trust them. It will be, I think, a society of trust. The other thing is ethics has been mentioned, and there will be an ethical dimension as well, because this is a topic we've talked about in these sessions before, the question of the way we treat animals. I mean, at the moment, animals are sort of used for science in all sorts of ways, often very cruelly used. But I think if scientists want to use animals for experiments to improve the human lot, if you like, what they will be obliged to do is to seek a wider mandate for that, whether they can do it or not. And it will be for the sort of, you know, for the socialist public at large to decide the balance, whether that should happen or not happen. Some people will be dead against it, others will probably be for it. I'm sure what I would be, but okay, you know, but people, then people would abide by democratic decisions taken. So I think there are those two areas, sort of resources and ethics, in which it will be necessary for a wider, if you like, non-scientific public or non-specialist scientific public to be part of the decision making. Don't know whether you'd agree with that, Leon, or not.
Broadly, yes. I'd just like to add a couple of things. So one thing to keep in mind, I think it's important to realize that there are some aspects of scientific work that people who are not familiar with it, they cannot, they wouldn't be able to imagine what kind of benefits it can bring. So if you normally ask people, so what are they doing at CERN? Why even have this collider? Why do we need it? I would say, yeah, I would struggle to give a good answer. I've been there. To give you some background, I've been at CERN. They explained it to me, and still I forgot a lot. But at least I got an impression that, aha, so that's why they're doing it. I just remember realizing it. So there are other aspects like that, which most of the people just wouldn't be able to decide. This is why people's assemblies, for example, they invite experts to explain to them these little details, like why do we need this? Because if you just simply ask this question to people, so do you want to make a drug or make a hadron collider? They would say, no, let's make a drug. This is something, you know, closer to us, something we understand. So I think it's either needs to be put into kind of more understandable context or to put to the decision to certainly not one person or a few people, but a lot of people who are familiar with this. That's one thing. And the ethical aspect, I just wanted to mention, because I worked also with animals in the laboratory, that this is a phase that's going to pass. So right now, people are working more and more with organoids, these little lumps of cells that one day will simply replace work with animals, I believe. So it's not going to continue forever, I'm sure. And even just if you think about, for example, work with mice and compare it with number of fish that people catch and kill every year, it's incomparable. We kill, murder dozens, hundreds of times more fish. And yet, as a society, we accept it and we say, oh, that's fine. Even though it has been shown that fish suffer and they feel pain almost exactly like we do. So it's also being considered by scientists a lot. Thank you.
Thanks, Leon. What you say about laboratory use of animals, the future of that, it's good to hear from my point of view. From my point of view, certainly, anyway. We don't have anyone else in the queue for the moment. Has anybody else a question to ask? We've had almost an hour and a half of very good discussion, I think, since Leon finished his talk. So we could wind up there. But does anybody else want to make any points? Well, if not, do you want to say anything? You don't have to, but do you want to say anything to conclude, Leon?
Just that it's been a brilliant discussion, and just thank you so much, everyone. I really enjoyed it for sure.
Thanks very much indeed. Okay. Right. Thanks to everyone for coming, and thanks to Leon for the discussion which he stimulated. Thank you.